change the story, change the future, a living economy for a living earth. So let's welcome David, first of all. Thank you. And just thank you for bringing your skills and your perspective for all these years to this conversation. It's just an honor to have you here. And what better way to start off the conference with somebody like David? Now, Matthew Fox, I have sort of a personal, fun story to tell you, which is that I grew up in Southern California, about 60 miles east of LA, and it was sort of like one of those soccer-playing, tract home, Orange Grove neighborhoods that was like equidistant between three military bases, so you kind of get the drift, right? There wasn't like a heck of a lot of consciousness running around out there. But as I moved into my teenage life, I started to have these personal experiences that were very profound. I grew up in an agnostic family, no religion, not a lot of spirituality. My mom was a little bit into feminine spirituality, which was awesome. But I started to have these experiences and synchronicities and connection with some deeper consciousness, experiences of oneness, and read the book Stranger in a Strange Land, which completely blew my mind open. And, you know, so I was 17. I got my first job. I got my first tax refund check, which was $300. And on top of it was a brochure from the University for Creation Spirituality. And it was a $300 workshop to come up here to Oakland and to spend 1 week with Matthew Fox, Brian Swim, Louisa Teesh, Star Hawk, Jeremy Taylor. Never heard of any of it. I was like, I'm going. So I come up, I was 18 years old, like what, 2 miles from here, and had one of the most transformative experiences of my entire life. So I just bless you for starting the University of Creation Spirituality. Now, the sad story was Matthew was actually silenced that year, so he didn't get to teach. But it was still an unbelievable experience, so I kind of credit you partially with being here at all. So thank you. Matthew Fox is a spiritual theologian, an Episcopal priest, and a social activist who has written 33 books. He established the Institute in Culture and Creation Spirituality and then went on to found the University of Creation Spirituality. Matthew has been honored with the Abbey Courage of Conscience Peace Award, the Gandhi King Ikeda Award, and the Tikkun National Ethics Award. And I welcome you here to help us kick off this conference.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I understand we're going to start with David. They'll then move on to Matthew, have a dialogue, or
actually,
the
I'm
opposite?
Give a little map,
okay, Matthew first, and then David. Yeah. And then at the end, if you'd like to comment or ask questions, you'll have the opportunity to do so, so you guys will let them know when they have that ability. And that is going to happen at this stand up here. So we're not going to run around with a microphone. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a brief question, please come up to this stand, and then you'll be able to do so when they let you know. So thank you all for being here, and have an amazing evening.
Thank you, Cassandra, and thank you to IONS for bringing us all together, and we're happy to be helping to kick things off this Thursday night. I just want to give you a little map of what we're intending to do this evening so no one gets lost. We're going to have like 4 rounds of topics, and David will kick off the first and the second round. He will go about 15 minutes. I'll go about 15 minutes. And after the second round, we'll have ourselves a break, a 10-minute break or so, and then get into the third round. And then the fourth round is your round. And we're going to be asking you to work at your table with the question or two that we have, and then toward the larger group as well. So about 2/3 of the evening is us, and about 1/3 is you germinating and sharing your ideas and your questions as we move along. Now, the topics of the rounds are these. The first is a human awakening, observing the trajectory and discerning the purpose in creation's creative unfolding. So that's round one. Round two, a troubled earth, confronting the consequences of obsolete ideas and institutions. There are a few of those floating around, you may have noticed. And round three, which I will open, will be a window of opportunity, finding our human place as lovers and healers of a living earth. So that's the simple trajectory that we're intending to follow this evening, and there'll be some give and take along the way. So, David, looking forward to your wisdom, as usual.
My clock started. I'm actually going to stand up, I think, for the actual presentations. I find the energy flows easier, and then Matt and I are here easily for conversation. We're at a time in the human experience where there's a need for a very deep rethinking of who we are and where we're headed, and I suspect you've noticed that. And what a situation for IONS, because IONS is really about our way of knowing. Now, one of the things that I've learned over time, we often talk about what is our human nature. And we have a lot of definitions of our human nature, and we got a lot of reason to think our human nature is not doing too well right now. To me, the thing that is distinctive about humans is that it is within our capacity to choose our nature. We can be essentially anything we want to be. And we choose through our choices of culture, our cultural stories, and our institutions. And if we get those right, we can be a lovely species, loving and cooperative. If we get it wrong, oh man, we demonstrate some pretty terrible possibilities. This is why our stories are so fundamentally important. And part of what's been fascinating to me in just preparing for this session is reflecting back on the history of my own thinking, which is also related to the history of our human thinking. And for most of us in this room, within our lifetimes, there has been an extraordinary shift in our understanding of who we are and what our place is in the cosmos. This is just within a few decades, whereas normally these kinds of shifts in humanity take place over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. We also are at a point where we have to navigate an almost instant, fundamental transformation in our way of thinking and our way of organizing as a species. In any realistic assessment, what we need to do at this point is impossible. The task before us is to make the impossible inevitable. So you ready? Now, how many of you remember Willis Harmon? You know, back, it was actually just a few months after my wife Fran and I, Fran here, got married. We were both graduate students at Stanford, where Bill was at, we called him Bill at that point, where Bill was a electrical engineering professor at Stanford. And Fran pointed out, you know, there's this course by this guy named Willis Harmon. He's an engineer, but it's on the human potential. Looks interesting. So we actually ended up signing up, and it's one of the few courses that changed the course of our lives and our thinking. Willis was at this time part of a group of very special scientists who felt that science had gone about as far as it could go in understanding reality based on conventional scientific method. And this was a course at a time, and it's only been, you know, very recently this has begun to shift. The science was very committed to the idea that only the material is real. You know, this whole conference is about relationships. Essentially, science ignored or denied any relationship under the pure mechanism. So at that point, life is an accidental outcome of material complexity, and consciousness is an illusion. That stripped reality and life of any meaning, of any purpose. And wow, that's kind of depressing, to be alone in this vast universe, a mistake with no meaning and no purpose. Now, okay, got to be very conscious of time. Think of the incredible shifts in our thinking and understanding that have taken place since IONS was founded in, what was it, 1973 by Edgar Mitchell. And then subsequently, Harman became the president of IONS, and the founding vision was, you know, Edgar realized that the story of ourselves as told by science, our cosmology, our religion, was incomplete and likely flawed. I recognize that the Newtonian idea of separate, independent, discrete things in the universe wasn't a fully accurate description. Anyhow, within a very brief period of time, again, mostly within our lifetimes of those of us in this room, we moved from believing that the total reality consisted of only two galaxies. You may have noticed the most recent estimate is there may be 2 trillion. So that's a bit of an advance in our sense of the vastness of reality. We have gone from a theory of the universe that was called the steady state, by which understanding everything that is in terms of that cosmos has always been there and always will be. We've gone from that to the Big Bang, which actually begins to approximate Genesis in terms of a sequence of events unfolding toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. And as we begin to see that unfolding in its detail, we begin to get a sense of creation revealing its intention and its purpose. The consciousness, the intelligence, that we think of as the beginning of creation, or you can think of it as the big, well, pre the energy cloud, burst forth in this massive explosion of energy, all totally uniform, unformed, and yet over time, evolving toward greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. That tells us very much about what is the intention and the fact that we are all part of it. One of the dramatic things in terms of our understanding of life on Earth is how in the earliest stages of the evolution of life on this Earth, somehow these simplest single cells organized together in relationship with Earth's geological processes to transform the surface of this planet, to create an environment unlike any planet that we still have yet found in this vast universe that was capable of supporting complex species like ourselves. Oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. And no other planet have we been able so far to suggest or identify has anywhere near the surface requirements required to support our kind of life. That makes this planet rather special, and our responsibility to it very special. When my first introduction to the complexity of how this organizing works came back, and it was about 1996. It was shortly after I had written When Corporations Rule the World, and I was looking for a new economic framework. And I knew it had to have something to do with how life organized, but the only kinds of theories that I'd had about life were the Darwinian competition of the meanest and most ruthless, which was not what Darwin thought, but how it's been interpreted, and that's what life is about and how life advances. And I met this amazing woman, a microbiologist named Dr. Maiwan Ho of Chinese ancestry. Just happened to meet her at a conference, but she'd seen some of my work. And she said, I want to talk to you about the relevance of my work to economics. She said, you know, conventional biologists, when they just go about to study life, they'll take a living cell, they'll grind it up, study its chemical composition, and think they've learned something about life. She said, I take living cells and study how they organize energy, information, nutrients, and water to maintain themselves. Of course, in a whole dynamic that is absolutely opposite of entropy, but organizing toward and maintaining order by intention. And then she talked to me about our bodies. And this is what just really blew my mind. This was the whole shift in consciousness about life. Our bodies are comprised of tens of trillions of individual, what we sometimes now call mammalian cells. Now, this doesn't include the microbiomes, which are even far more numerous now than these cells that are an integral part of our body. So what she was explaining to me is that these cells are in constant exchange with each other. They're not only managing these nutrients, water, energy, and so forth, but they are also engaged in exchange. And in the case of an emergency, they can and will transfer energy from any part of the body to any other part of the body at a speed faster than the speed of light. This is cooperation of the most extraordinary sort. And it's all done by these individual decision-making beings, all doing in a way that supports the crucible, the container of our consciousness and our agency, and yet we are totally unaware of all of what's going on. So they do it all by themselves, all just so that we can sit here and talk to each other and we can talk about how we're going to change the world and so forth. That's real agency. But as we go further, this is the pattern that we see in life. And this is basically what we humans have to learn to be able to do. How can we organize society where we recognize that the whole purpose is life, part of this whole cosmic mission? And how do we learn to organize a way that instead of destroying Earth and destroying one another, we actually support the advance of this process? So I'm going to turn it over to Matt, and then we will pick up later. We'll talk about the ways in which this has gone wrong, and then we will also, in the third, talk about the possibilities. Matt, please.
Thank you, David.
Well, I think you've really laid out how stories can interfere with the reason we're here, the stories that we're taught and the stories that we ingest. And as you say, the difference between a rugged individualism versus this sense of cooperation and community that is in fact going on not only within our bodies, but in ecosystems and all the bodies of beings on this planet. So, and when you mentioned the 2 trillion galaxies, I remember it was last summer that this news came through when scientists said, whoops, we were wrong, there aren't a few hundred billion galaxies, there are 2 trillion galaxies. I was just blown away, and I still am. I think it's still reverberating in my body, seeing nothing of my mind, that we live in a universe of 2 trillion galaxies and we can talk about it. We can imagine it. We can make this discovery. We are a pretty unusual species. And I'm struck by what Rabbi Heschel says. He says, the universe is not just here, it shocks us into amazement. It shocks us into amazement. And he says that one of the deepest problems with humanity is that we're not shocked enough. We don't taste deeply enough of the awe and wonder and what he called the radical amazement that we are truly capable of. And for me, that is another way of talking about the mystic that every one of us is. The mystic is not someone who is asleep or has tied their consciousness to tales and stories that are self-defeating and one-dimensional and proven wrong and dangerous to a great extreme. So I'd like to address a few issues of what keeps us asleep today. One thing is denial. I was at a conference a year and a half ago, it was in Florida, on the seas rising, and it was January of 2016. And the first speaker was a scientist. He got up with slides, showed a picture of Florida today, 10 years from now, chop, 20 years from now, chop, chop, 30 years from now, chop, chop, chop. One lesson I learned was I'm not sure I'd invest in real estate in Florida. Maybe dinghies and rubber boots, but not real estate. And at that time in Florida, there were three national politicians, two running for president of the United States, and the third, the governor of the state, who were in public denial about climate change and seas rising. And I visited South Miami. There are 6 inches of salt water in the streets. So the power of denial cannot be underestimated. Just as we are these spiritual beings that are capable of discovering 2 trillion galaxies in our home or the mysteries of our bodies and community there, we are also a species that can deceive ourselves for the sake of ideology and lies. Meister Eckhart, the great 14th century mystic, said, God is the denial of denial. It's another way of saying that if we're in denial, or if half of our population is, and a whole political party is in denial, God is nowhere to be found because truth is absent. God is the denial of denial. When we can begin to melt denial, divinity and truth and beauty and possibility, hope can flow again. Another issue that keeps us asleep is that of, well, Lester Brown. I was with Lester Brown some 23 years ago in Bristol, England, at a Schumacher conference. And he was the first to speak, and he spoke about the environmental revolution. He said, we have 20 years left. That was 23 years ago. Yes, to change our ways as a species. We'll not be able to undo the damage we're on. And that he ended his talk saying this, the number one obstacle to the environmental revolution is apathy. That was his last sentence. Then it was my turn to speak. And I appreciated that because he opened the door for me, just like this scientist in Florida opened the door. I followed on him. Everyone was so depressed after the scientist spoke in Florida. They were like dish rags in their chairs. But I did address the topic of denial, and it became quite familiar to them since they're living in Florida, and they know their governor. So anyway, apathy, of course, is the capital sin that the medievals called acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A, acedia. We've mistranslated it as sloth. It's much more than sloth. It's about depression and despair. Aquinas says acedia is a lack of energy to begin new things. So that's the issue. Where is the energy? Where is the moral outrage? We're sitting on our anger. We're sitting on our moral outrage. We have all kinds of people, many of them who consider themselves pious, who run around telling us, oh, anger, you got to sit on anger. Anger's a bad thing. Anger's a bad thing. Well, it isn't. Anger is a fire that gets things moving. Every political movement in this country, from abolition to the women's movement, to the gay and lesbian movement, to the ecologic movement, certainly the civil rights movement, was about lassoing anger and have it work for us or it doesn't. So that it doesn't run away with us and turn into violence. But that's what Gandhi did, and that's what King did, to lasso anger, because anger is very vital. Thomas Aquinas said, nothing great happens without anger. Anger is that fire that keeps you going through the tough times and through perseverance. And he also said, a trustworthy person is angry at the right people for the right reason, expresses it in the appropriate manner, and for the appropriate length of time. Now, empire builders, including St. Augustine, who was the theologian behind the Christian empire in the 4th century and beyond, and, of course, the slave masters, are the first to tell us that anger is a sin, you see. Don't tap into that anger. Of course not. It might turn things over. So this is another issue, then. There's denial. There's apathy. And part of lighting the fire to go beyond apathy is healthy moral outrage and learning to steer it into creative dimensions and into healing. Now, again, Aquinas says the solution to acedia, to the lack of energy, begin to things as this. He says, zeal comes from an intense experience of the beauty of things. That is such good information. You want energy again? Fall in love and get over the anthropocentric stories we've had that falling in love is about finding one two-legged mate till death do you part. Good luck at that. It's a great goal, but it's not the whole picture. It's so darn anthropocentric, or in Pope Francis's appropriate language, narcissistic, it makes me throw up. We're here to fall in love with wildflowers and with trees and forests and elephants and oceans and rivers and stones and giraffes and polar bears. We're asleep because we're not in love. And our imaginations are not running over time because we're not in love. And I can't believe that 50% of Americans cannot have their hearts attuned again to the wonder of our being on this wondrous planet with all these wondrous beings and still carrying on our narcissistic agendas. I don't think that is sustainable. How am I doing timers? You tell me. Nope. Do you know? Okay.
No, I haven't
timed. Oh, I see. I didn't time. Well, I just kind of, okay. One more point here. David raised the point about the loss of meaning in a materialistic universe. And of course, that is so real. You don't get your wonder up. You don't get your energy flowing. You don't get your fire going. You don't even get your moral outrage working if everything is bleak and without meaning and purpose. So I want to call on Thomas Berry, one of the great geologians, one of the great prophets of our time. And here is what he proposed as the purpose and meaning of our existence. And of course, he did spend his adult life learning world religions, but also science, today's science. Here's how he put it. The human adventure depends absolutely on this quality of awe and reverence and joy in the earth and all that lives and grows upon the earth. In the end, the universe can only be explained in terms of, and I'm going to leave that blank for 1 second. In one word, how would you name the end of the universe, the purpose of the universe? Here's Thomas Berry's word, celebration. In the end, the universe can only be explained in terms of celebration. It is all an exuberant expression of existence itself. This, my friends, is a return of meaning. And it's not the return of utilization. It's not about how better to exploit the earth, the animals, the trees, the ecosystems. It's about looking at the human heart in our communities. Are we interested in recovering, discovering this basic purpose of the universe, joining the rest of creation? Because it is about celebration. It is an exuberant expression of existence itself. Years ago, I had a dream, very important dream. It's what Native Americans call a dream for the people, not just for myself individually. The dream had this one sentence in it. There's nothing wrong with the human species today except one thing. Now, that's an unusual statement. If I asked you to take out a paper and pencil, I bet you could come up with 99 things in 10 minutes. One thing, you have forgotten the sense of the sacred. That's what the dream said. We have forgotten the sense of the sacred. It is in that context that this arousal of celebration, this renewal of reverence and joy and gratitude will be reborn. The awakening happens there, just as Rabbi Heschel said, with the recovery of awe. And awe is a beginning of wisdom. We've had our run with knowledge, and knowledge is a good and useful thing, but it's not enough. It's not enough. Knowledge by itself can become power, a power trip. We need to embrace it with wisdom. And wisdom brings in the issues of caring, of justice, of compassion, of forgiveness, of creativity itself. Hildegard of Bingen says, there's wisdom in all creative works. So it is this burst of creativity that is born of the new meaning, which is, in fact, an ancient meaning that we're in a position to recover and rediscover today. And that is that we are here to celebrate with all beings in the universe, and we are capable of it. Thank you.
One of the things I did in preparation for this was to look at the ION's mission, which is to broaden knowledge of the nature and potentials of mind and consciousness, and to apply that knowledge to the enhancement of human well-being and the quality of life on the planet. That has never been more important than it is right now. And it's all about pulling together the deeper meaning and implications of the advances in our knowledge and the ways in which those advances are connecting with the ancient wisdom of indigenous peoples, the great religious prophets, and now with the leading edge of science. And even the first edges of science, where they were concerned with the material, was deepening our understanding of the material aspect of our being. But what I want to focus on in this second session, we're focusing on the troubles that we are in as a species and why we are in that trouble, which is partly understanding the failures of our existing stories. And the way one way I think about it is that kind of the fundamental problem that we are in currently with stories that destroy our sense, strip our sense of meaning. We are a species that has a deep hunger for meaning. We have to have a purpose. When that purpose is stripped away, the demagogues can step in and give us all sorts of promises of meaning, of purpose, and in that way control us. And that has been actually a pattern of empire throughout 5,000 years. And it explains, I think, many of our traditional, now increasingly seemingly archaic kinds of religious beliefs that Matt goes into so beautifully. Now, one of the things that I'm beginning to see, and I want to check out with you here, I find more and more of my conversations with my friends and my colleagues reflect a deep sense of despair and fear. The sense that where we are headed as a species is a place where no one wants to go. Anybody in the room have that feeling from time to time? I see some hands that are a little reluctant to go up. If we look closely at what science is telling us, we're basically on a path to self-destruction of Earth's capacity to support human life. Now, that's not just bad. That is potentially the end of the species, but it is also potentially the end of this extraordinary creation story of life's trajectory on this planet, unique perhaps in all the cosmos. Now, this is a tragedy of the deepest order. And the cause, the responsibility, is clear. It's us. And it is actually, we can trace it through, a product of failed stories. And stories that are being delegitimated and cast aside by the frontiers of science. But it takes us a while as a species to get caught up with our own understanding. And this is the challenge that we have got to confront. Now, one way I think about this, you know, to me, I've come to feel one of the most meaningful of verses in the Christian Bible is the statement that no one can serve two masters. Either you serve God or mammon. I think of that either. We live to serve the spirit of creation and creation's unfolding. In other words, serving life. Life is sacred. Or we end up organizing to serve money. And that is exactly what we do now. In our loss of meaning, we are convinced, okay, we'll find our meaning, our purpose, our satisfaction in consumption. And that causes us to chase money, so we create an economy that is basically geared, its primary purpose, to make rich people richer. Now, one of the simplest things that we have to understand is the nature of money. You know, we think of it as a piece of paper with a number on it. But most of our money now is not even on paper. But whether it's on paper or not, it is nothing but a number. It is created from nothing. And it has no meaning except that by convention we accept it for things of real value. So if we create an economy in which a few people are able to gain control over the creation and allocation of money, they control everything. Now, I tend to define our current crisis by two statistics. The first is that this is the environmental issue, that now as a species, and I'm sure you've all heard this statistic, as a species we now consume 1.7 times what Earth can sustain. That's the Global Footprint Network. Everything over one is exceeding Earth's regenerative capacity. And this is recognizing Earth as a living superorganism that with all the species working together and along with Earth's geological processes, somehow through methods that we still haven't the Well, we do have the slightest, but only the slightest barest clue of how it works to maintain the temperature, the climate, the soils, the fisheries, the forests, all the things that our living actually depends on. So the more we consume beyond what Earth can regenerate, we're simply destroying Earth's capacity to serve life. And that trend is all in exactly the wrong direction. So that is a path toward species self-suicide. Now, the other statistic, which is equally breathtaking, is that eight individuals sit around one of these tables easily, control half of all the world's financial wealth. That's equal to the wealth of 3.7 billion people. You can say how much inequality is too much. Clearly, that is too much. And the trend is exactly in the wrong direction. That figure has shrunk down to 8 at a speed that is just unbelievable. So what we have is we've got an Earth that is generating less and less of what we require to live. And what remains of that capacity is owned by fewer and fewer people who use that control to impose their will on the rest of us, control our politics and so forth, in order to extract even more of what is left of this declining pool. So that is the simple summary of our current economic story. And we buy into it because we are told and we fall into the belief that money is wealth and that making money creates wealth. So the people who are making money are the world's wealth creators. We should celebrate them and further rewrite the rules to increase their ability to increase their own fortunes. Now, all of this relates back to stories. And the foundational piece is coming back to this deep reality that we are living beings. We are part of creation's unfolding. Our lives have extraordinary meaning. Now, here's another piece that I've only really begun to grasp almost literally in the past few days. We have become Earth's enemy. We have become like an invasive species. And we know that living organisms, and Earth is a superorganism, they mobilize to reject invasive species. And we're beginning to see signs that Earth is beginning to do that beyond just our own damage, but the release of other sources of carbons up in the Arctic and so forth, which one could interpret as our strategy to get rid of this invasive species. Now, many of us take some marginal comfort in the idea that, well, if we destroy ourselves, then that leaves Earth free to recover, and the rest of the species can begin to recover and regenerate and so forth. So, a few billion years lost, but, you know, what's a few billion years in the history of creation? I've just recently been exposed to a different theory. Organisms do not always recover when they get rid of the invasive species. Earth may not be in a position to recover without humans. This leads to a very, very interesting question. Is it possible that the recovery of Earth's health actually depends on humans, but engaged in a wholly different relationship with Earth than the way we relate now? Relationship not only to Earth, but as well to one another. and around the goal, how would we organize to meet the material needs of 7.5 billion people and growing, and do it in a way that is in balance with the living Earth, and actually is facilitating not only the Earth's recovery, but ultimately it's further moving forward towards still greater beauty, awareness, and possibility. That is the challenge that we will jump into in the next session. But now we turn to Matt to get his take on the crisis that we are creating in our ignorance.
Just to pick up, David, on your point about consumption and economics of consumption, in this, you talked about the suicide path that we're on as a species. I'm reminded of two things. One is Adrian Rich's comment about how patriarchy contains a lot of fatalistic self-hatred. Fatalistic self-hatred. So I ask that question, is our species been succumbing to fatalistic self-hatred? This wrapping up of so much of the wealth and with it the power of decision-making on the planet with just a few people or a few corporations and so forth, what's beneath that? What are we really afraid of? And what is it we're really hating? And I link that hatred to some religious ideas. For example, original sin. Now, there is an old story that needs to be buried. It doesn't come from Jesus. Jesus never heard of original sin. No Jews ever heard of original sin. It comes from St. Augustine, the 4th century, the very time when Christianity married the empire, or took it over because no one else wanted it. And there it was. If you're going to run an empire, original sin is a great idea because everyone in line, no one asking questions, and it gets them kneeling a lot and begging for forgiveness. But it doesn't get things done because it does not empower. And so I see consumer capitalism to be the secular version of original sin. Because original sin is telling you, you don't have what it takes. And really, your being here is a problem. You're a blotch on existence, even though it took 13.7 billion years to get you here. Nevertheless, it's a real blotch. So you see, I think that there are many stories today, such as our arrival after a 13.8 billion year journey, that wash away a lot of original sin ideology. Again, that ideology is so anthropocentric, so narcissistic, that we miss out on the real history of the universe, the real story and stories that we all carry. So I'm just proposing that displacing original sin with original blessing, that this earth has been blessed not only for the 14.5 billion years of its existence, but for all those billions of years that brought it into existence. Indeed, I was reminded in your opening remarks about choice. I was with a very renowned biologist several years ago, and he said, we're the first species in 4.5 billion years of the planet that can choose not to go extinct. They're the first species that can choose not to go extinct. But then he said, of course, we haven't made that choice yet. And that's what you're talking about. Yeah. We've been making these other choices based on stories that are completely inadequate. And of course, this whole question of fatalistic self-hatred, I think that original sin feeds that mentality, that doubt of our right to be here, and is completely disempowering, both psychologically and sociologically, and that is why there's such an investment in original sin in the religious sphere, or I think consumer capitalism in the secular sphere, because consumer capitalism is saying you don't have what it takes. You got to buy it from the outside. You need this salvation that we call advertising 24/7 a week and a day to make yourself bright again and glistening again and glowing again and beautiful again. In contrast, Hildegard of Bingen in the 12th century said, everything we have that is necessary for life is within us. Everything that is necessary for life is within us. That's a very different beginning. And to draw that forward, and if it's within us, then it's within your neighbor, and it's within your clan, and it's within your community. And we have to bring it alive and bring it out, celebrate it, and educate for it, educere, lead it out. Look at most of our education is about stuffing things down the throats of young people instead of bringing out the beauty that's already there. The educational system itself is owned, lock, stock, and barrel by these same forces and this same ideology of fatalistic self-hatred. It begins really with an original sin doubt that people aren't really here to learn anything, that learning isn't fun, that learning isn't beautiful, that learning isn't sacred. But it is. Think about it. And radically, learning is cheap. Education isn't, but learning is. I always say, learning is like eating a delicious meal. Just like our stomachs are made for delicious food, so our minds are made for truth. And it absolutely turns you on to discover truth. And I want to say a few words about the vocation of the scientist. How many people here would call themselves scientists? And I don't mean necessarily professionally, but maybe natural scientists, but just lovers of science, of course. Well, you know, Aquinas said, I quote Aquinas a lot because he's a pre-modern thinker, and we need some pre-modern thinking, both from indigenous wisdom, but also the pre-modern thinkers of our own lineages sometimes. Aquinas said, a mistake about creation results in a mistake about God. Now turn that around. An insight about creation results in an insight about God. And this is what scientists are about. They are hunter-gatherers for the truth about what's going on in nature, what has been going on in nature, and what might be going on in nature. Of course we need science. We need science desperately. But, you know, I've gotten in the habit over many years of interacting with scientists to ask them this question. When was the time when you first knew you wanted to be a scientist? 100% of the scientists I've asked that question have responded identically. First they scratch their heads and they say, gee, I haven't thought of that for 40 years. Then they'll say, I fell in love with a bush when I was 5 years old. I fell in love with a worm when I was six. I fell in love with a star when I was 6 years old. Every single one tells me about a love affair, a vocation, a calling they had when they were five or six. I once asked that of Rupert Sheldrake, who I think is with us this weekend, and he said to me, there he is, and he said, wow, I haven't thought of that. I fell in love with this bush when I was 5 years old that my father introduced me to. Then he said, oh my God, I never thought of this. I did my doctoral thesis on that bush. So it's a love affair. But where did all that love go? How much of the scientist's vocation has been sucked into this vortex of what Thomas Berry calls barbaric academia, that's serving interests that are not about celebrating the earth, are not about gratitude and reverence and recovering the sacred, but are about a, quote, good job, good pay, good position, and good grants, but not rocking the boat? Where has a passion, that hunter-gathering passion for truth and justice, where has that gone? And can we call it back? I want to say this, that I define a priest. Archetypally, a priest is a midwife of grace. A midwife of grace. So as I point out in my book, The Reinvention of Work, anyone who's doing good work is a priest. Because you are a midwife of grace, whether you're a carpenter, a mechanic, parenting, a counselor, a scientist, a mathematician, what have you. Being a midwife of grace. That's what a scientist is. A midwife of grace. And I think we have to move beyond these stories of ecclesial hijacking of our important archetypes, such as priesthood, and realize that we're all here to be midwives of grace. That's how the sacred gets spread. That's how it gets awakened in the younger generation. We're not here to play sadistic games to students in a system that was sadistic toward us. We're here to break that system open so that love can flow again, and creativity, and the ecstasy of learning, the joy of learning. I worked with inner city kids, teenagers, a few years ago. I took my pedagogy that had really worked with adults, but took it to the inner city, because 64% of black boys in America drop out of high school. And it's not because they're dumb, it's because they're bored. And so I reintroduced creativity there. And 100% of the students said they wanted to stay in school now. And one day, I'll never forget, the senior, 18-year-old African-American guy turned to me and said, this is the first time in 4 years of high school that anyone has asked me to express myself creatively. Huh. Wow. So if we can't educe, if we can't bring the creativity out of one another, then of course we are doomed as a species. And this system that is preventing that from happening, and I will bring into this sense of system the accreditors, because I ask, who accredits the accreditors? I've never met an accreditor that still had their mystical brain intact. The mystic in us is a lover in us, and that is what gets stifled in a patriarchal, control-oriented, consumer capitalist-driven, original sin-supported structure. All that has to melt and fast if we are to rise as a species. And with that resurrection will come a balance, a gender balance of the feminine, the quest for wisdom, and the masculine. It's not about one or the other, but we have to recover a sense of the sacred masculine to detox what patriarchy has done to a very understanding of what masculinity is really about. Is it about building these monuments to immortality for the few? Only a few pharaohs built could have those pyramids in their honor, you see. I think that it's this fear of death that turns us into being fatalistically full of self-hatred. And it is this flight from our love of life, from passion for living, from what Howard Thurman called the life within the life itself, that is killing our species and our culture at this time. Thank you.
The break?
So, a few minutes for discussion, and then we're going to break. Okay.
Oh, so do...
There's a question back and forth or something?
Oh.
And then we'll take our break. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
I'm fascinated by your discussion of learning, which I think is absolutely foundational.
Discussion of what?
Learning.
Learning. Oh, uh-huh.
I think my question is how your understanding of creation and creation spirituality fits or does not or goes beyond my kind of simplistic idea that all of creation is an outcome of a spirit seeking to know itself through a process of becoming. And that that whole bursting forth of creation is actually a process of learning. You know, it's not like a God waved his hand and all of creation came forth, but it's all the expression of intelligence, consciousness, seeking to organize through matter and learning new ways to do that such that it brings forth this creative flow of the arc of creation.
Well, I love your language. You're thinking in cosmic terms, and that's so important. I go back again. I'm hearing a lot of Aquinas tonight, but I go back to this great line from Aquinas: "Sheer joy is God's, and this demands companionship." So, the purpose of spirit birthing the universe is not just to know itself, but to rejoice and to share the joy. And I think that's fundamental, and I think it overturns a lot of our structures and our thinking. And yes, it displaces education with learning. And I alluded to that earlier. The experience of learning, at least for me, I'm sure it is for everyone here, it's an ecstasy. Truth turns you on. It's a joy. It's a delight. And there's joy, of course, is often talked of as a spiritual gift. So what that means to me is it's not a limited. It's not, there's not a rationing of joy that has to happen. There's a lot to go around, and then some. And, you know, when you're joyful, you get together with someone else who's joyful, well, that creates a third, more sparks. And that's celebration. And this is where I think ritual is an important part of learning, and it has been for most of our species until the last few centuries, that that the big lessons in life are taught through ritual, where the body's involved, and where not just thinking, but dancing and heart work, and all the chakras are lit. And, you know, I see that as the shortcut to telling these new stories that you're so keen on naming for us, and you name so well. So I think that's all part of the learning process.
Let me test you on another piece of this kind of intrigued with. We think about sometimes in meditative practice of melding back into the oneness of the spirit, which presumably was the original condition of whatever we think of as reality prior to the Big Bang. Now, it strikes me that while that's all very peaceful, it's also damn boring. You know, you talked about expressing happiness. There has to be another. I also have a sense that to know oneself, there has to be other, there has to be difference, there has to be diversity. And that's part of the explaining of why creation did what it did in terms of bursting forth, giving expression of matter, which then created the possibilities of all this really interesting, beautiful unfolding, which makes existence a whole lot more interesting.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think diversity makes life more interesting. And to me, divinity is extremely diverse. Divinity, after all, how can you match an imagination that's birthed 2 trillion galaxies, you know? Or that's birthed giraffes and wild geese and poison ivy, you know? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I think divinity gets an A+ for imagination. But the idea that divinity, you know, it's both and. Divinity also has this this silent side to it, mystery as well as history. And we're that way too. You know, we have a contemplative side too. We need to be still at times and to commune. And at other times, we can be raucous and joyful. So I think some of our joy is orange, and some of it is blue and blue-green, you know. And I suspect it's the same with spirit, that, you know, like the scriptures say, you know, be still and learn that, you know, that God is there. The stillness is really important, but it's not everything. Mm-hmm. So, and I agree, once the decision was made to invest the joy into creation, that is to give birth, things changed. And but we have to remember, like you said, we have to remember that dimension of stillness and quiet and the void and the darkness as well. So there's the apophatic, the dark divinity, there's a cataphatic, the divinity of light. And again, we have to play with these experiences and archetypes in our own beings. That's how I see it.
Now, I'd like to hear you say more about the darkness. Now,
ooh.
In one of our discussions preparatory to this session, you made this statement that really struck with me, that without the night and the darkness of the night, we could not see the other galaxies. We could not see the vastness of creation and space. But I would like to hear you reflect further on the darkness and what its importance is, its contribution, and particularly what that might tell us about the darkness that we all know about our current political situation.
Yeah. Well, the mystics talk about the dark night of the soul, and I'm talking about the dark night of our species. I think our species is in a collective dark night today, and we should recognize that and take the lessons from the mystics. And one thing they say about the dark night is it's a very special place to be. You learn things in the dark night that you don't learn elsewhere. You learn things in the dark you don't learn elsewhere. Again, we've been running on this language of the Enlightenment for several centuries, and we paid a price for that because we can turn darkness into light with a switch. But darkness holds its own sense of reverence and stillness and even humility, because in the dark, and you're together more in the dark. There's less diversity in the dark. And of course, today we have many stories of the Black Madonna returning and coming into people's dreams. Not all Christian people by any means, all kinds of people having dreams of the Black Madonna. Why is that? Because the Black Madonna represents the cosmos, the darkness of the cosmos. We are now talking about dark matter and dark energy comprising 95% of the matter in the universe, whatever all that means. But the point is that darkness is beginning to move in to center stage. And of course, the emergence of people of color, which are by far the greater number of human beings on the planet, acknowledging their beauty and their empowerment and their right to be here. So our darkness is stirring. And I think that if I were a betting man, I would say the future of God talk is around the apophatic divinity, the God of darkness, more than around the God of light alone. And now, some of the darkness, of course, like some light, it can be uncomfortable, and it can also be painful, like the dark night of our politics that you're talking about. But it's a wake-up time. We want to pay attention to this darkness, to how the feelings we're having about the end of democracy. You know, we want to name it. You don't want to sit on it and go shopping. You want to face it. That's what the dark night, that's what the mystics are saying. Be with the dark night. Be with the pain and what it has to tell us. And what does it mean that we're facing the end of democracy as we know it? What is it asking us to do? Out of this darkness, our calling, our vocation, whether you're a scientist or a teacher or a politician or a business person, is going to be redefined. So Maestraka says the ground of the soul is dark. So if we're going to go to the depths and not just stay up at the superficial place of happiness and light, you're going to expect the darkness. And you know, I think it was Edgar Mitchell himself who talked to me about being out in space and experiencing this mystical experience of the darkness of space and the silence of space, those two things. This is what woke his soul up out there and made him the mystic he was. And it happened to all kinds of cosmonauts and astronauts, that they encountered this deep darkness of space, like you do the darkness of the depths of the ocean. But Eckhart, the depths of ourselves are dark. So it's a great moment when we're finally beginning to entertain the dark again. And it is moving out of that enlightenment one. Now, here's my question for you, and we get a break. You like to talk about a new enlightenment, a second enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So why don't you speak to that right here at this juncture, and then we'll give people a break.
I'd love to speak on the new enlightenment. I also want to make one comment about democracy. Because I think this is one of the insights that this current experience has certainly brought into my thinking. And that is that really we have never had democracy. Yeah. We've had sort of hints of democracy. Mm-hmm. But it's been, even that part has been a very short part of our U.S. experience, let alone a global experience. And for the most part, the communities of color never experienced that, as they never experienced our middle class. And so that's part of the awakening. And I thank Mr. Trump for his help in forcing us to see some of these things.
Unveiling.
Now, in terms of the new enlightenment, I mean, basically the original enlightenment was about the mechanistic science. It broke us out of the kind of dark, magical spirits, the kind of view, the magical sense of the universe's creation, to an understanding of how it actually unfolded. And I think that's actually very important, because partly to me, it now, that piece of it helps us see the connection between the spirit and matter, the kind of two elements. I mean, as I looked on this, I thought, I think I understand now what creation spirituality is about. That creation, what we see as creation from the Big Bang forward, was a process of the creation of matter, but in connection to spirit, in a way that takes us back to learning that, you know, it wasn't like God waved a hand, but God has been expressing through all these elements of creation in this process toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. And that matter was essential to that, and that to really understand, you know, like living beings, where is the separation between the matter and the spirit and the awareness? And that, to me, just gives a deeper and deeper meaning to your frame, creation, spirituality. Mm-hmm. And then as we get into quantum physics, we begin to realize, well, maybe even the quantum particles are not quite as physical as we thought, and the relationships between them, and they're evolving. But how do they get together so they get the order that creates this illusion of stability that is, again, all essential to our experience of creation, and in a sense to the spirit's sense of creation? Mm. So to me, the new enlightenment is this process of melding the knowledge of science and the understandings of religion and the frontiers of science, so we begin to get a fuller picture of the connection between spirit and matter, so that we have a much deeper sense of the outpouring of creation. And then we come to the question, well, we as the most self-aware of species, we with a self-reflective consciousness and a capacity for agency, for choice, the choice of whether we whether we choose our own extinction or not. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a distinctive feature of our species, but it also, as we begin to recognize that, recognize we also have an extraordinary distinctive capacity to facilitate the continued unfolding of creation in on its intended trajectory, mm-hmm. and not for us, but with us as living beings, of earth beings, of cosmos beings. Hmm. I don't know, how's that set? You're the author of Creation Spirituality.
I like it, I like it. There's so much there. If I could just comment on one thing, the non-dualism that science, I think, is returning to. When David Bohm says matter is frozen light, to me, that's the end of thousands of years of dualism in the West, because when I look at all the world spiritual traditions, the number one metaphor for divinity is light. You have it in Buddhism, you have it in Christianity, you know, I am the light of the world, you have it in African religions, you have it in Celtic religions, you have it all around the world. And now, if you say, well, matter is frozen light, then you're putting matter and spirit together.
Yeah.
And it's the end of dualism. And then to go deeper into what science is saying, but incarnated light that we call matter is rare in the universe. I've been told that for every molecule of light that is matter, there are a billion molecules of light that are not matter. So, wow, that means incarnate light, that is human flesh, earth flesh, animal flesh, and so forth, this is rare in the universe, one in a billion. And here we've had this bad story that flesh is the pathway to evil. Well, it's not. And that's where getting this new story, which is really a much more ancient story, mm-hmm. that there's not a war between matter and spirit. But there is this community, like you were talking about with the body. There is and Aquinas called it the admirabilis communio, the wonderful communion of matter and spirit. Mm-hmm. And he got condemned for that 3 times by the bishops in his day. So right after
just
he died.
Like you.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of that going around. So I get extremely excited about that, and I'm so glad you brought it up, that science can assist us in moving beyond the dualism, and therefore to a much healthier science and a more healthy spirituality.
And that was the vision of the founding of IONS.
There you go. What a great way to end. Take a break for 10 or 12 minutes or so, and we'll come back for more, and for your participation. Thank you.
Hey.